From the campus of Yale University, this is Business Talk with Jim Campbell, nationally syndicated across the country on the Biz Talk Radio Network and coming to you from our flagship stations, Yale Radio WYBC and 1490 AM WGCH Greenwich. All talk and all business, 60 minutes of radio with leading figures from the world of business along with the business of politics and sports. Taking a bold stand against white nationalism, the former governor of Virginia during the Charlottesville tragedy, and now just after the mass murders in El Paso and Dayton, we'll hear the inside story from Governor Terry McAuliffe of the violent, hateful Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville. He'll tell us how to prevent other Charlottesville's. That's all tonight on Business Talk with Jim Campbell. Terry McAuliffe served as governor of Virginia from 2014 to 2018, chair of the National Governors Association from 2016 to 2017, chairman of presidential campaigns of both Bill and Hillary Clinton. Former chairman of the Democratic National Party. His first book, What a Party, was number 5 on the New York Times bestseller list, number 1 on the Washington Post list, and this new book, destined to become the definitive behind-the-scenes account of Beyond Charlottesville, Taking a Stand Against White Nationalism, just hit the New York Times bestseller itself.
I have a message to all the white supremacists and the Nazis who came into Charlottesville today. Our message is plain and simple. Go home. You are not wanted in this great commonwealth. Shame on you. You pretend that you're patriots, but you are anything but a patriot. You want to talk about patriots? Talk about Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, who brought our country together. You think about the patriots today, the young men and women who are wearing the cloth of our country. Somewhere around the globe, they're putting their life in danger. They're patriots. You are not. You came here today to hurt people. And you did hurt people. But my message is clear. We are stronger than you.
Welcome, Governor. Honored to have you. That was really passionate.
Thank you, Jim. It was a tough day.
Tough day, and that was August 11th, 12th weekend of 2017. And to go through this quickly, you phoned President Trump. You got a sense that he was going to help defuse this, and what happened?
That's a great question. So the president called me in the morning. Obviously, he called the governor of the state in a crisis, and I explained what was happening. I had 1,000 of these neo-Nazis, white supremacists, screaming the most vile things, beating up people, and they're all carrying weapons. And I talked, and I said, you know, Mr. President, your rhetoric's got to stop. This hate speech going on is really dividing the country. And we had a good conversation about it, and he agreed we got to move on. So I hung up the phone, said he'd do his press conference. I'd wait for him. But then a half an hour went by, an hour went by, hour and a half, 2 hours, two and a half. And what happened, my best guesstimate, Jim, is that, you know, Miller or Bannon or one of the guys in the White House said to the president, no, you are not going to condemn neo-Nazis. You're not going to condemn white supremacists. You're not. And he came out that day, and he said there were good people on both sides. Well, I was there. There are not good people with their swastikas, their Adolf Hitler T-shirts, screaming at Jews that we want to burn you like we burned you in Auschwitz. I'm sorry. The president lost his moral authority. He came out as a full-fledged white nationalist racist that day.
So now we've just had Dayton and El Paso. Are you in the same position of his coming up little on this stuff, or what's the level of accountability?
Oh, he's culpable. There's no question about it. I mean, clearly the killer from El Paso, you look at his manifesto, he talks about building a white America and a lot of the tweets from Trump. Listen, Trump has said that all Mexicans are, you know, rapists and murderers, and you know, he wanted to ban all Muslims from our country. He retweeted neo-Nazi white supremacists when he was running for president. He has created, Jim, this culture in this country. You know, in the old days, these racists would wear hoods and they do it at night. Because of Trump, they feel emboldened and they can come out in the middle of downtown Charlottesville at 10 o'clock in the morning and say these types of things. And he's culpable. And that's why I was disappointed in his speech the other day. He should have come forth and said, I apologize. My hate rhetoric has stirred people up. I'm going to stop it. And we'd be in a different place in this country today. But, you know, that's not who Donald Trump is. I don't say it lightly.
When you were running the state of Virginia, you see there are 378 Confederate monuments still and very few for the Revolutionary War and, of course, the Robert E. Lee statues.
Right.
Was it the culture was changing the culture of Virginia a big challenge as well?
Well, and I talked at the beginning of the book how when I ran for governor, you know, I was from New York. My experience, you know, when I was out campaigning, I went, you know, ran into a Ku Klux Klan rally at one event. I didn't know, to be honest with you, Jim, that the Ku Klux Klan was still having rallies. I had, my wife was insulted at another event where she gave a guy a flyer, the guy running the event, a huge political event. And he said, I'd never vote for your husband because he's an N-lover. And it's just disgraceful. But you know what? You can't define a whole state by a few racists. And it's the same thing I said about the folks at Charlottesville. 1,000 people. They came in from 39 states. You know, we're a nation of 330 million. But, you know, the problem we have in this country today is that people feel emboldened. And I worked hard as governor. You know, I restored more felon rights than any governor in American history. You know, I did more pardons than any governor in Virginia history. I leaned in. I took the Confederate flag off the license plate in Virginia. You know, I did everything I possibly could to move Virginia forward. And the good news is we're a different state today. That's why Amazon, Google, Facebook, Microsoft all put in operations in Virginia, open and welcoming. But it's taken some time.
The in fact, I found if you restored, is restoration of voting rights, is it, for 206,000 Virginians?
That's right. So we had a horrible system in Virginia that if you were a felon, and remember, a felon, Jim, is anything over $200. If you stole anything over $200, you were permanently disenfranchised for the rest of your life. We were one of three states. And it goes back to 1901 when a state senator by the name of Glass put it in our Constitution and said, I'm doing this, quote, to eliminate the darkie from being a political factor in Virginia. Well, 114 years later, with a swipe of my pen, I gave everybody back their right to vote. En masse, going back 75 years, Republicans sued me, took me to court, and I ultimately won. And now we have several hundred thousand people that have their right to vote back. But I also, Jim, in the book, talk about a racist criminal justice system. I talk about one man who I pardoned walking out the door, Lenny Singleton. Lenny Singleton was a drug addict. He had problems with drugs, of course. And you know what? He did five robberies. The most he stole combined for all five robberies was $535. And nobody, Jim, was ever injured. What do you think his sentence as a young African-American for stealing $535 was?
I don't even want to guess.
Take a guess.
$535. I would have said it should have been 18 months, 2 years, 5 years.
Yeah, close. Two life sentences plus 130 years.
It's worse than Madoff.
Right.
Jesus.
I'm telling you. And so this is what we got to address. You know, we got the bad as Charlottesville was, it did rip off the scab on racism. And it's prevalent. It exists today. And we got to lean in. We got inequities in school and sentencing and health care and housing. We got to lean in and deal with these issues.
You know, tell us a little bit about you. You watched the Charlottesville thing loading up from the vantage point of the governor's office. You did not have direct authority, I guess. What do you think? Right. Was stuff missed there? Or you saw this happening. Go through it.
Yeah, so we call it unified command. Most states have it. You're up in Greenwich now, right, Jim?
Yes, sir.
So in Greenwich, if you had a crisis, the city of Greenwich, if it happened there, would be in control and the state would be there in support.
Mm-hmm.
So in Charlottesville, they ran the show. And I make some things that needed to be fixed. Their permitting process, you know, they gave this permit to these Unite the Right knuckleheads.
Yeah.
And they didn't put any restrictions. They didn't, you know, banning poles and sticks. The park that it was held in was too small. The time was too long, 5 hours. So my point is, not being critical, but we need to do a better job on the front end of constraining and putting restrictions around these people. The key to controlling a protest is to keep the two sides separated. This park was like your backyard. There is no way you could have 1,000 armed people and 1,000 or 2,000 counter protesters in this small. It was just a volatile mix that, you know, that permit should never have been granted. In the manner in which it was. And finally, the city on Wednesday night said we're going to move it from Emancipation Park up to McIntyre. McIntyre was a big park. You could keep people separated. And unfortunately, the ACLU sued on behalf of the neo-Nazis And the judge at Friday night at 9 o'clock said, no, we're going to let them keep it at this park. They were wrong. The ACLU was wrong. The judge was wrong. I'm for First Amendment. But let me tell you this. If law enforcement says I can't keep you safe, that should trump those First Amendment concerns.
You'll see the Business Talk with Jim Campbell over the Biz Talk Radio Network, 350 stations around the country. Go to biztalkradio.com to find the station closest to you, to listen over the Internet, to access our inventory of podcasts. Coming next with Terry McAuliffe, Tragic Outcome in Charlottesville. Our guest, the former Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe. He was governor during the Charlottesville White Nationalist Rally back in 2017. How do you, Bush had this 9/11. What hits you when you get a sense of a defining moment like this in your life and in the term of governorship? How did it hit you? When did you know?
Well, you're so busy during the day, Dio, and I finally declared a state of emergency. And so at about 11:15, I'd seen enough through my people on the ground, and I wasn't supposed to call the state of emergency, the city was, but I'd seen enough. And so about 11:21, I authorized the state police to move in. They cleared the park in about 11 minutes. The National Guard came in, secured the park. So at this point, by 11:50 on Saturday morning, we felt pretty good. I mean, we'd had some fights, but no one had really gone to the hospital. It was serious. And you know, no property damage. But then, as you know, Jim, about an hour and a half later, this James Field nut weaponized his car, ran into a crowd of counter-protesters and injured 35 people and killed Heather Heyer, 32-year-old Heather Heyer. And then a couple hours later, the state police helicopter, my pilot and a former member of my security detail were killed that day. So it was hard, but when I went to give that speech that night, it was the hardest thing I had to do because Trump had so screwed up his speech, I knew I had to speak for Virginia and the country to say, this is not who we are. And just before I walked out, literally 5 minutes, they told me that the helicopter had crashed and that both of these troopers whom I was close to were killed. It was hard.
In fact, that was your helicopter, right?
That's the one I used. So my pilot that I used all the time, and Burke Bates had been on my personal security detail, and had just gone over to be a helicopter pilot. And that night I went and saw both families, both of them with two young children. It just breaks your heart. But for Charlottesville, but for these folks coming in, Heather Heyer would be alive today, and most likely these two state troopers would be alive today.
What are the single most important things we need to get done so that these things don't keep happening?
I don't want to make today political, but getting rid of Donald Trump, only because he is inciting people with his rhetoric. It's just awful, the things he says. Elijah Cummings, the squad, is just doubling down on this white nationalism that, you know, we got to make America all white. And, you know, it's stirring up these people at home. And it's horrible. The other thing I talk about is we got to deal with education. You know, you've got a young African-American kid goes to a school, doesn't have the same quality teacher, maybe not the same supplies or same infrastructure, and it rains and water comes in. We just got to get equities in our education system. To me, that's the biggest thing we can do, because that child, if he doesn't have early in life, he is destined to have problems the rest of his life, and it's not fair.
Terry, is Trump a sort of a symptom of the dysfunction in Washington amongst both parties, and we have a generation of folks that haven't had any income increase and haven't had job improvements, and this is the kind of resentment that comes out of it?
Yeah, I mean, listen, income inequality, Jim, I agree, is one of the biggest things out there. People have not seen their personal financial system go up, and that is a frustration that people are dealing with. I mean, listen, Washington's broken. I mean, that's why I always think a governor should be the president, because, you know, you're a CEO. You got to run your state. You got to balance a budget. You got to create jobs. You got to build roads. You got to clean roads. you know, folks in the Senate get to talk all day. They don't have to do anything.
Yeah.
And we do have dysfunction. These gerrymandered districts are horrible. But you just got to get back to a place where people get in and, you know, do the job that they're supposed to do. You know, I inherited a huge deficit when I became governor. I left the biggest surplus in the history of the state. Hundreds of thousands of new jobs created. People were happy. Deliver it for the people. They're not asking for much.
By the way, that leads me to ask, why aren't you running for president?
I wanted to, be honest with you. I spent a year preparing. I went to 25 states.
Mm-hmm.
I believe I was clearly the most progressive governor in Virginia history, but also the most pro-jobs.
Yes.
You know, I turned our economy around, took unemployment from 5.4 to 3.6. Personal income went up 12.5%. But, you know, there were 25 people running.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm very close to Biden. I didn't think he was going to run. And then he decided to run. Most importantly, is, you know, we had a few issues in Virginia. So I've had to come back home and take charge of the elections in Virginia. I'm still a young man, Jim. Who knows?
Okay. Now, Trump, you knew him when he was a Democrat, which I didn't realize how much of a Democrat he really was, even pro-choice. You played golf. Yeah. You played golf with him. Does he know what he's doing? Is he competent? What are your thoughts?
You know, he was a Democrat his whole life. He was pro-gay rights, pro-choice. I mean, his whole thing was a charade. I talk in the book about meeting with him. You know, he gave me a check for $25,000 when I ran for governor in 2009. You know, in early 2011, like January, I went back up again, said I'm re-gearing it up again. And I said, now I can't help you again. I may run for president. I said, Democrat or Republican? He said, well, I'm really not sure, but if I give you a check with and I'm running as a Republican, that would hurt me. Trump is not a Republican. Trump is Trump. And it's, you know, he just has no moral core. That's the most bothersome thing to me. You know, I go to the end of the mat with things I believe in. Even Republicans in the legislature said, you know, no one should be surprised. He said he was going to do this. He believes in it. That's what elections are for. Trump is like a weather vane. You know, it's all about how he gets reelected, and he doesn't care about any core issue.
Assault weapons ban, background checks. What are the most important things that could happen legislatively?
Oh, my goodness. If we got the Senate, you would have, right off the bat, universal background checks, which are 94% of Americans support universal background checks. They all support assault weapon ban. They all support getting rid of these high-capacity magazines. And they all support closing the gun show loophole. This would happen, Jim, so fast. It would happen in Virginia this year when we win the legislature, and it will happen in the country in 2020. I mean, common sense. I mean, you know it. Common sense gun restrictions. We're not, you know, we're not taking anybody's gun away, but there are people who shouldn't own guns.
Are the Democrats going to be able to contest Trump, or are they going to self-destruct with going too far left?
I don't think they're going to self-destruct. It's early. I honestly, Jim, think it's going to be very hard for Trump to win again. If you look at three states, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania,
right,
we lost those three by 77,000 votes,
right,
and yet 92 million people didn't vote. They woke up the next day and said, holy cow, how did that happen? And they came out big in 17, they came out big in 18, and they're going to come out big in 20. So we're going to win those three states, and we're not going to lose a Hillary state. So, you know, it's almost impossible in my mind for Trump to win again unless, you know, we screw it up, which we can, and, you know, form a circular firing squad. But, you know, odds are that Trump is going to be defeated. He can't, you know, in the electoral college states today, we win in a walk today.
I have to say, I enjoyed reading this book. You know, I obviously am not from Virginia, so I'd always seen you as kind of a politician. You've run all these campaigns very close to the Clintons. And yet you come off here as a really passionate guy fighting against racism and all of the cynicism. The book is Beyond Charlottesville, Taking a Stand Against White Nationalism. Just hit the New York Times bestseller list. The guest has been former Governor of Virginia, Terry McAuliffe. Thanks to Terry. Thanks to our national audience. We'll see everybody again next time on Business Talk with Jim Campbell. The book is The Real Trump Deal, an eye-opening look at how he really negotiates. And our guest is Marty Latz, who is an expert on negotiation. And we're going to talk about some of the deals that cratered now, which seems to be that he took his eye off the ball at some point in the 90s or something. But I want to start first
with what I call almost cons, which is Trump University, which, you know, was not really what it was, and unfortunately ripped a lot of people off. The Trump Network was a pyramid scheme type of, these are licensing kinds of deals. Talk about those.
Jim, what he was able to accomplish after The Apprentice became such a blockbuster hit was to trade his name for deals. And one of the things I think that he probably learned from his series of failed deals in the mid-1980s, Trump Shuttle, Plaza Hotel, the Trump Princess, you know, how many casinos in Atlantic City, he wasn't a very good operator. He really wasn't a very good manager. Whether he recognized it or not, he found that after he went, in effect, way under, as we talked about before, and The Apprentice came along, he found a way to financially trade in on his reputation. And it really started to take advantage of one of his true skills, which is self-promotion. So he self-promoted. He got that name out there, and Trump became synonymous with, you know, gold apartments, success. And he took that and he tried to sell the name. He tried to sell the reputation. That's where Trump University, the secret real estate sauce, that's where he sold the branded shirts, the vodka, and you just name it. But he wasn't operating it. He was saying, hey, you pay me just a check each year, and you can use my name. You operate it, you do it. But one of the problems, and the problem that Trump University ran into in a lot of ways, is he's doing these licensing deals with shady characters.
Yeah.
And he's not really overseeing any of it. He didn't care. He's getting his check.
Why would you do business with shady characters? I mean, is he just blind to that? Or he just wants money?
I think that he was focused on winning. And the way he perceived winning was name recognition, promotion, and a check. And a significant check. And he didn't really view litigation as particularly problematic as long as net-net he's winning. He's getting those checks. And so I think that, you know, from a reputational perspective, his reputation was driven by The Apprentice. And even though, you know, there are lawsuits here and there, he can always argue, as he did, that there are two sides to every story. And if he pays them off or settles the lawsuit, he's still getting more deals because his name was out there as this masterful business negotiator, masterful business leader from The Apprentice, which continued to rake in the money.
So if you look at Trump University, there was no there, and he didn't handpick the guys out, and he didn't give the profits to charity, and he upped credit limits for people that couldn't afford it. I mean, you don't have to look very closely to say it would be destined to fail.
This is all predictable. It's not just Trump University. It's what he's doing as president right now because he has a history of this type of promotion. I mean, even in his first or second big deal, Trump Tower, you know, he had this pseudonym, John Barron, that he used
yes.
and called and spoke to the press. And so how did he sell apartments in Trump Tower? Well, he calls up members of the press in New York, and, of course, they're printing anything that he says because Trump Tower, it's big. It became the place to live at the time, and he said, hey, do you know who recently is looking at buying a whole floor in Trump Tower? It's Princess Di. She was here last week.
Yeah.
And, of course, the press, the gossip press, they run it. And are there any consequences for Donald Trump? No. But the buzz is out there, and he's winning. He's selling based on these rumors. So when you look at Trump University, you can see precursors all the way through. How did he sell this? How did he promote this? It's a pattern.
I'd talk a little bit about what it's like to partner with Trump in two things, the USFL, and then he took the casinos public, which means he had shareholders as partners. Talk about the USFL first, because if that's a screw-your-partner deal, I don't know what is.
Well, I'm telling you, you know, he had a couple of goals when he bought the New Jersey Generals in the USFL. One really was to try to leverage his ownership into an NFL franchise. And he was going to do it at all costs. And he didn't care about the rules. for the USFL. It had a very different management philosophy up until the time, but he became the face of the USFL, and by becoming the face of the USFL, he created sufficient leverage with the other owners so that if he pulls out, they got a problem on their hands. And so they ended up going along with him, and they went along with him right down the tubes.
and they moved to the fall, which didn't make sense. He lost them the NBC contract. He signed LT, Lawrence Taylor, but Philadelphia team supposedly had the rights to him. You just go on and on. Was it, from a personal point of view, Trump's self-interest, was it smart to leverage to try to, an antitrust suit to try to get in on the cheap, or was that just, you know, irresponsible?
Well, at the end of the day, he lost $22 million on this entire effort. On the other hand, he won the antitrust suit against the NFL. And the NFL, you know, I think was very aggressive against him. And he only lost, he won the suit, but he only got $1 in damages.
Yes, yeah.
But keep in mind, it was a split jury, and he only lost by one vote. So he came very close.
Wow.
To winning in that particular situation.
Now, he testified under oath about what the commissioner of the NFL, Pete Rozelle, said to him. And either Rozelle or Trump are lying under oath.
Well, that's right, Jim. And what's really interesting to me about the testimony, it was a secret meeting that Pete Rozelle, the head of the NFL, and Donald Trump had before the USFL sort of pivoted and decided to go head-to-head with the NFL with a fall season. Traditionally, their whole business model was the USFL is going to be in the spring, the NFL can stay in the fall, they'll build up their teams, and ultimately maybe there will be a merger. But Trump didn't have patience, doesn't have patience now, didn't have patience then. He pushed for the fall, and the antitrust suit was about, hey, the NFL is going to try to keep us from being in the fall and keeping a competitor. So before they jumped into that, Donald Trump and Pete Rozelle had a meeting, and one of them, you're right, was not telling the truth. Interestingly enough, Pete Rozelle, after that meeting, he took notes about it. He talked to his friends. He wrote a memo to the file. Does that sound familiar to you, Jim, vis-a-vis James Comey?
And you'll also see that he has a history in depositions of saying stuff that doesn't appear to be true, which is supposed to get you in trouble, isn't it?
Well, that's right. You know, when you make material misrepresentations or you lie under oath, you know, that's supposed to be a real problem. But he really has never had to face up to significant problems or significant legal problems, although he's been investigated a number of times.
I want to talk about taking the casinos public. I mean, they had crashed, basically, or he had crashed. And he was able, and so he goes and gets partners or shareholders, but he's able to essentially transfer all of his debt and lousy stuff and oversell his businesses to the public entity and basically rip them off.
Well, it's amazing. I mean, who among us wouldn't love, if you're in a negotiation, to be sitting on both sides of the table at the same time? So you've got here public company DJT. He's playing off his reputation. Even though he went, in effect, under with his businesses in 1990, the public didn't perceive that he had really, truly failed in everything because his partner bank sort of covered it up and let him get away with it. So now he's going to play in on his reputation. He creates a public company. He raises all this money. And now, of course, he's CEO of this public company. So what does he do? He's going to go buy those casinos, which, by the way, those casinos, he had a lot of personally guaranteed debt on them. So what does he do? He overpays Donald Trump on the other side of the table, and he's out from under that debt. And guess who pays in the end for all that debt? The shareholders.
And the numbers.
A lot of money on those deals.
The numbers are amazing. He goes public for $14 a share. It's $140 million. It reaches $36 a share, eventually drives it to 17 cents. He sold the Hilton Castle from himself to the public corporation for $520 million, and then the corporation sold it for $38 million. They lost $1 billion in profits in 10 years. Trump made $44 million in compensation. And then I like the comparison of performance. $100 of Donald J. Trump, DJT stock in 95 would be worth $4 in 2005, MGM, the competitor, $100 starting in 95, be worth $600. And that's the performance as a public, running a public company.
Well, and I think, Jim, what's really important about what you said was you can't say, he can't claim that it was the market. He can't claim that it was somebody else's fault. He was running it, and at the same time he was running it, it's going downhill, and at the same time somebody else is running a similar gaming company, it's going straight up through the roof.
All right, we got our final segment coming up. We'll talk about whether Trump can be a successful president or not. We're back, international negotiating expert Marty Lance. So we've talked about the fit between his skills and what you need in Washington. He's got a lot of big things on the table: North Korea, Putin, Iran, the wall, immigration. Did get the tax cuts through. Do you think that Trump can be a successful president, and he might be reelected just because the economy's good?
Well, he might be reelected because the economy's good. You know, if you take a look at a lot of the indicators, you know, the economy is not only doing pretty well right now, but if you take a look at the electoral prospects of presidents who run during economic good times, and it's pretty high in terms of reelection. You know, on the other hand, as you indicated, you know, other than getting his big tax cut passed by Congress, he really hasn't accomplished a great deal with regard to at least negotiations in his first 500-plus days, other than, of course, all the regulatory stuff that he's doing, which is significant, but he doesn't really have to do a lot of negotiations for it.
No, I don't think he's even involved in it, frankly. It's behind the scenes. The tax cuts are interesting, too, because I interviewed Larry Lindsey, who was Bush 43's head of the National Economic Council, and he said that they knew that if they failed in getting that tax cut done, the Trump administration would basically be finished, and that they were trying to do everything they could to keep him off the stage and out of it. So it's kind of interesting, and that's his biggest success.
And, Jim, you know, that's also in part because of the history of what Donald Trump had done during his negotiations to repeal and replace Obamacare. Because, in fact, there were three negotiations involved.
Yes.
There were two in the House, one in the Senate. In the first one with the House, it crashed and burned. In the second one in the House, of course, he succeeded. And in the third one in the Senate, of course, the famous thumbs down by Arizona Senator John McCain. There's a really fascinating story with regard to the Senate negotiation where President Trump sent down his chief of staff at the time, I think it was Reince Priebus, to meet with the Republican Senate caucus. And he goes down and he says, you know, the Senate caucus was meeting, the Republicans in the Senate were meeting, and they told Priebus, you can sit outside. You can't even sit in the room with us.
Wow.
Can you imagine? I mean, one of the master negotiators at the presidential level in our history was Lyndon Johnson. Whether you like him or you hate him, everyone recognizes he was a master negotiator.
Yes.
True arm twister. Boy, oh boy, can you imagine the United States Senate telling his chief of staff, you're not even going to be able to sit in the room?
Let me ask you this. We're just talking about whether he can be successful as a president. Was he successful as a businessman? I mean, if he put his inheritance, right, as we say, into an index fund or something, he'd be worth $5 billion. We've gone through all these deals that cratered. Was he really successful as a businessman?
Jim, we don't know. we just don't know. You know, I mean, he didn't, despite promising to release his tax returns after his audit was done. We don't know what he's worth. I mean, clearly he is a master promoter. Clearly he made a lot of money from licensing.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, he was able to recover from a devastating financial crisis in 1990. Clearly, he is a very good actor, and he was very successful on The Apprentice. Is he a good business operator? I would say, based on an objective evaluation of the evidence, no. You take a look at his casinos. Did not operate them efficiently, effectively. Did not make those shareholders money. Is he running, or was he running prior to becoming president, a pretty successful licensing operation? Well, he probably was. A lot of it was likely based on his reputation from The Apprentice. How much of that was smoke and mirrors, like Trump University, we don't know. But clearly, he's got his own 757.
All right, let me ask you. Let me ask you this now: do ethics matter anymore? In the book, there's a lot of you go through lying and misrepresentation, bullying, and threats. Twitter, of course, he's out there name calling and demeaning people, and then litigation like crazy. Do those things matter?
Absolutely, they matter. I believe that Donald Trump would have gotten the Senate to repeal and replace Obamacare had he developed an ethical reputation and had not called Senator John McCain a true war hero.
Yes.
Not a war hero. I mean, I'm sure Senator McCain would say, you know, he solely made his decision
yes.
based on the merits of that deal. But, you know, if you're on the fence, if it's in a gray area, do you say thumbs up or thumbs down? He said thumbs down. Ethics matter. Telling the truth matters. And I think we're seeing that in his relative lack of legislative accomplishments. I mean, as you said, Jim, he got his tax cut through, but he hasn't gotten much else.
The bullying and the threats and Twitter, does that matter? Is that doing, you know, and we just talked that it may have cost him that vote because of McCain. But, it demeans the presidency the way he goes about it. But it just seems to be accepted now?
Jim, it not only demeans the presidency, it's ineffective.
Yeah, that's
it really doesn't work.
Interesting.
There are some very limited circumstances under which threats, based on the research, can be effective. But doing it instinctively or intuitively, negotiating by Twitter, is not the way to go. The goal of a threat has to be to change their behavior to give you what you want. It should not be retaliatory tariffs. It is not. It should not be to spiral the relationship downhill. And yet that's what has happened. When you personalize and you call the Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau,
yeah.
What he called him, you don't get the benefit of the doubt in our trade negotiations over NAFTA, and you don't get an ally in negotiating with China. You get just the opposite.
And what about negotiating that Mexico's going to pay for a wall and giving no out for Mexico to be able to work around that at all?
You know, Jim, you're putting your finger on, again, a really critical part of negotiating as president that is different from negotiating in business. It's what we call behind-the-table negotiations. In business, you're at the table. You're the decider-in-chief. You can make a determination as to yay or nay on the deal. In a presidential context, at the same time you're negotiating at the table, you need to be negotiating with your constituents, and so does the other side. What Justin Trudeau said in his press conference after that G7 meeting was focused on his domestic audience. And apparently President Trump really didn't understand it. He reacted instinctively or intuitively
yeah.
to it, and that caused a downhill shift, not only in our relationship with Canada, but with everybody else that was at that G7 meeting as well.
Well, the book is fascinating, and as I said, it's put together on a fact-based basis. You can make your own conclusions, and in a world of fake news, that's a healthy way to be. Thanks to Martin Latz, his book, and it's just out. The Real Trump Deal, an eye-opening look at how he really negotiates. It's been Business Talk with Jim Campbell. Thanks to Marty Lax. Thanks to our national audience for listening. We'll see everybody next Sunday on Business Talk with Jim Campbell.